prior approval from the Defense Department. Rather than announce the information control policy, SyncPAC would simply respond to reporters' requests by placing them under review. To support the president's desire to keep Vietnam from encroaching on his domestic political agenda, McNamara had disconnected what he said from what he knew. By the end of January, in contrast to the optimistic assessments that he had given to the representatives and senators, he concluded that he had to force LBJ to make a decision because he thought that South Vietnam was on the brink of total collapse. McGeorge Bundy agreed. Both had supported the president's holding strategy, but they now believed that unless they focused his attention on Vietnam, his indecision would lead to disastrous defeat. They asked to see Johnson on January 27th, and, with McNamara's approval, Bundy wrote a memo to prepare the president. Bundy and McNamara argued that the persistent instability in the Saigon government stemmed from a lack of hope in the future among South Vietnamese officials and the public at large. In part, they blamed American inactivity in recent weeks for a feeling of uncertainty and lack of direction among both Vietnamese authorities and U.S. government officials in Saigon and Washington. They argued that the president's policy of waiting for a stable South Vietnamese government limited the United States to a policy of first aid to squabbling politicos and passive reaction to events we do not try to control. Bundy and McNamara told the president that the current policy was the worst course of action and condemned the United States to an essentially passive role which can only lead to eventual defeat and an invitation to get out in humiliating circumstances. They then pressed him to choose between two alternatives: use American military power to force a change of communist policy, or negotiate a withdrawal aimed at salvaging what little can be preserved with no major addition to our present military risks. They recommended the first option. Both of us have fully supported your unwillingness in earlier months to move out of the middle course. We both agree that every effort should still be made to improve our operations on the ground and to prop up the authorities in South Vietnam as best we can. But we are both convinced that none of this is enough and that the time has come for harder choices. Bundy alerted the president that Rusk did not agree with their assessment, but closed by emphasizing that he and McNamara had reached the point where our obligations to you simply do not permit us to administer our present directives in silence and let you think we see real hope in them. William Bundy recalled later that his brother's memo summed up the feelings of all of us at the time. Johnson's closest advisors had put the president at a fork in the road. The memo and the meeting galvanized LBJ to action. He had avoided decisions on Vietnam earlier, first because of the election, and then because the Great Society had preoccupied him. Now, faced with a strong argument for action from the men who had helped him navigate a middle course, and confronted with the danger of division within his own administration, he vowed that, stable government or no stable government, we'll do what we ought to do. We will move strongly. The president, however, needed an incident to which the United States could respond with military force. In hopes of provoking a North Vietnamese attack, he authorized the resumption of destroyer patrols in the Gulf of Tonkin. The Joint Chiefs of Staff responded immediately. On January 28th, General Wheeler ordered Admiral Sharp to resume DeSoto destroyer patrols on February 3rd. They would be the first since September of 1964. The patrol's principal mission was to provoke a North Vietnamese attack that would, in turn, trigger an American reprisal. Wheeler ordered retaliatory forces into position before the destroyer patrols commenced and told Sharp to anticipate hitting five reprisal targets in the southern portion of North Vietnam. A few days later, Wheeler modified his instructions to allow more flexibility and to include targets more suitable in terms of Washington objectives. It was, McGeorge Bundy recalled, like waiting for a streetcar. The president wanted an unassailable justification for retaliation. Accordingly, the patrols were designed to avoid the criticisms of Oregon Senator Wayne Morse and others that attended the August 1964 incident. Unlike previous patrols that had passed within 3 miles of the North Vietnamese coast and had been conducted in close proximity to Operation 34 Alpha raids, the February 1965 patrol would stay 30 nautical miles from the coast, and the Navy would launch no 34 Alpha raids 48 hours before and after the patrol. Although he supported the DeSoto patrols and preparations for reprisal, General Harold Johnson still harbored doubts about the effects of bombing North Vietnam. On February 1st, Johnson warned the chiefs that any direct military pressure against North Vietnam could cause Chinese intervention. To avoid the errors of hasty deployment, which he had experienced at the outset of the Korean War, Johnson urged the chiefs to prepare for an escalation of the war on the ground. He wanted his colleagues to consider the consequences of their actions, but they never acted on his memo. The planning for air action against the North continued without consideration of its possible costs and consequences. The same day that General Johnson signed his memo, Lieutenant General Goodpaster, McGeorge Bundy, Bundy's assistant Chester Cooper, McNaughton, and William Bundy's deputy Leonard Unger left for Vietnam. President Johnson decided to send Bundy on the mission during his meeting with him and McNamara on January 27th. Although the president had already agreed to reprisals against North Vietnam, an action was planned to provoke a North Vietnamese act of aggression, he kept his decisions from all but his closest advisors. Cooper recalled that the president damn well had decided already what he was going to do, and that Bundy's trip was part of Johnson's effort to demonstrate he was considering all the options. The trip was designed to build consensus behind the decision to bomb North Vietnam. On February 6th in Saigon, Bundy and his team began to draft their report to the president, while the American embassy continued its attempt to remove General Khan from power. Despite disturbing evidence of political instability in South Vietnam, Bundy's group recommended that the United States take advantage of the first opportunity to strike North Vietnam. Galvanizing American public opinion behind the change of policy remained the only obstacle to its success. They agreed that the communists would have to do something dramatic in order to justify an airstrike against North Vietnam. According to Cooper, the thought was, we would take our lumps until something very dramatic came along. Bundy planned to spend his last day in Vietnam, Sunday, February 7th, making a leisurely inspection of economic and military assistance programs in the countryside. However, the Viet Cong disrupted his plans even before breakfast. Early that morning, Viet Cong demolition teams infiltrated the advisor's compound and airfield at Plai Khu in the central highlands of South Vietnam. A barrage of mortar rounds caused explosions that killed 8 American servicemen, wounded more than 100 others, and set fire to 20 aircraft on the airstrip. Goodpaster and Bundy accompanied General Westmoreland to the site of the attack. The airfield was in shambles. The sight of gravely wounded American servicemen evoked in Bundy uncharacteristically strong and visible emotion. In the White House, he and his staff had compared casualties in Vietnam to traffic-related injuries in the Washington, D.C. area and concluded that the numbers of American dead and wounded in the war were insignificant. The scene at Plai Khu, however, brought home the reality of the war. Thrust suddenly into a chaotic environment that contrasted sharply with the relatively orderly, controlled surroundings of the White House, he began to mutter, "We cannot stand by. just can't do this to our country. Westmoreland recalled that Bundy became intense, abrupt, and arrogant, as if under a sort of field marshal psychosis. The opportunity to urge the bombing of North Vietnam was cathartic for the emotional Bundy. The streetcar, for which he had been waiting, had arrived. Taylor and the Joint Chiefs supported Bundy's call for a reprisal. In Washington, Deputy Secretary of Defense Cyrus Vance briefed Lyndon Johnson on the attacks and the plan for retaliation against military targets in the southern portion of North Vietnam. Taylor made his own recommendation separately. The president deferred to the man on the spot in Saigon. General Wheeler issued the order to sink PAC the following day. U.S. forces would strike 3 North Vietnamese barracks, while the Vietnamese Air Force and Farmgate struck a 4th. As Bundy's plane was making its way eastward across the Pacific, he and the members of his group heard the White House statement on the radio. On February 7th, U.S. and South Vietnamese air elements were directed to launch retaliatory strikes against barracks and staging areas in the southern area of North Vietnam, which intelligence has shown to be actively used by Hanoi for training and infiltration of Viet Cong personnel into South Vietnam. Today's action by the U.S. and South Vietnamese governments was in response to provocations ordered and directed by the Hanoi regime. As in the case of the North Vietnamese attacks in the Gulf of Tonkin last August, the response is appropriate and fitting. As the U.S. government has frequently stated, we seek no wider war. The key to the situation remains the cessation of infiltration from North Vietnam and the clear indication by the Hanoi regime that it is prepared to cease aggression against its neighbors. After months of dutifully adhering to their president's instruction that Vietnam not interfere with the Great Society, Johnson's advisors, assisted by the Viet Cong, had finally pushed him into acting. Chapter 11, The Foot in the Door, February to March, 1965. I believe that effective interdepartmental coordination is leading the United States government down the path to a major contribution to the solution of what may be the greatest problem facing the free world today, subversive counterinsurgency. General Earl Wheeler, March 23, 1965. In February 1965, President Johnson made decisions that transformed the conflict in Vietnam into an American war. The February 7th Viet Cong attack on Plei Khu triggered the next step up the ladder of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's campaign of graduated pressure, carefully limited bombing of selected targets in North Vietnam. Although overt aerial attacks on the North escalated American involvement to a new level, the president's decision at the end of February to introduce U.S. ground combat units into South Vietnam represented an irrevocable commitment to the war. The president, however, would refuse to consider or even to acknowledge the consequences of his decisions, and thus still imagined that he could pursue a policy of gradual escalation without involving the United States in a major war. Although the Joint Chiefs of Staff thought that the president's policy was fundamentally flawed, their actions supported and reinforced it. Unable to resolve inter-service differences or to agree on the primary source of the problem in Vietnam, the chiefs submitted consensus recommendations that focused on individual military actions and avoided strategic issues. As a result, they did not force the president to face the fact that the commitment of ground forces would make it harder than ever to withdraw, and that additional forces would certainly be necessary. Instead, they resolved to push the president gradually along the course toward Americanization of the War. A member of the Army Operations Staff, then Major General Arthur Collins, recalled that all the services were anxious to get their foot in the door, and it reminded me of the story of not letting the camel get its nose in the tent. It was apparent to Collins that the U.S. would get far more committed than it intended, and it was obvious from the civilian influence on the tactics and strategy that we were just going to nibble away at this Vietnamese problem. On February 7, 1965, U.S. Navy aircraft carriers Ranger, Coral Sea, and Hancock were afloat in the South China Sea, waiting for orders to bomb North Vietnam. The Viet Cong attack on Pleiku provided the occasion to launch Flaming Dart 1, the name for the reprisal strikes against military barracks in the southern portion of North Vietnam. Ranger would strike military barracks at Vit Tu Lu, while Coral Sea and Hancock would target a barracks facility at Dong Hoi. The South Vietnamese Air Force would bomb a third facility. The airstrikes would comprise the first overt attack on North Vietnam since the Gulf of Tonkin reprisal in August 1964. All did not go as planned, however. Low cloud cover obscured Ranger's target, so the aviators aborted the mission. Pilots from the other two carriers also encountered poor weather conditions, but decided to press the attack at low altitude underneath the clouds. Streaking in at high speed, 29 aircraft from the Coral Sea began their run at the Dong Hoi barracks. Intense anti-aircraft and small arms fire reached up at the low-flying aircraft, shooting down one plane and killing its pilot. Fire from the ground and poor weather conditions limited the damage inflicted on the barracks. When the raid was complete, Vit Tu Lu had escaped attack, and the strike on Dong Hoi had destroyed only 16 of its 275 buildings. McGeorge Bundy and his party returned from South Vietnam late on Sunday, February 7th. Bundy went immediately to the White House to deliver the memo that he and his group had finished on the trip. He assured the president that the memo represented the consensus between his party and Taylor's embassy. Like his brother and McNaughton, McGeorge Bundy believed that protecting American credibility was the principal objective of U.S. policy. He argued that, in the eyes of the world, the United States was responsible for the outcome in Vietnam. American international prestige and influence were directly at risk. He told the president that, without new U.S. action, defeat appears inevitable, probably not in a matter of weeks or perhaps even months, but within the next year or so. He suggested that the Pleiku raid gave the United States a practicable point of departure for a new policy centered on the bombing of North Vietnam. According to Bundy, the United States was at a turning point in the war. Bundy shared not only McNaughton's doubts about the chances of success, but also his belief that it was better to commit American military force and lose than to forego acting. Although Bundy put the odds of a favorable outcome of the war at as low as 25%, he was 100% certain that, even if it fails, the policy will be worth it. To preserve American credibility, Bundy told the president, the policy of graduated and continuing reprisal was the most promising course available. Domestic and foreign political concerns reinforced Bundy's conviction that the president should deepen American involvement in Vietnam. Bundy's report argued that defeat after a substantial U.S. military effort would damp down the charge that we did not do all that we could have done, and this charge will be important in many countries, including our own. Although Bundy was impressed with the cost of losing South Vietnam without first committing U.S. armed forces, his examination of the possible consequences of deepening American military involvement in the war was cursory. He admitted that U.S. casualties would be higher and more visible to American feelings. But he dismissed that expense as cheap relative to the costs of withdrawal. He and his group concluded ambiguously that the value of the effort seems to us to exceed its cost. The president, preoccupied with his domestic legislative program, did not examine Bundy's program in any depth. When Bundy finished briefing the president, he was surprised when Johnson asked if there was anything new in his report. He replied, "Well, we thought we made a sketch of a program that didn't exist." Anxious to keep his decision to begin the systematic bombing of North Vietnam secret, Johnson disagreed. "No, that's where we are already. Let's just not talk about it anymore." As Bundy was about to depart, Johnson asked, "How many copies of this are there?" Bundy told him that several memos had been distributed. Johnson erupted, "Get them back!" On February 8th, Johnson cabled Ambassador Taylor that he was now prepared to go forward with the best South Vietnamese government we can get, and accordingly, I wish you to know that I have today decided that we will carry out our December plan for continuing action against North Vietnam. Johnson warned Taylor, however, that it was most important that this decision not be publicized. Taylor and McGeorge Bundy supported the president's desire to slip the country into war without public or congressional debate. Taylor agreed that the United States should explain the bombing of North Vietnam on the basis of retaliation to manage domestic and international opinion. Until the president deemed it appropriate to make public the decision to bomb North Vietnam on a continuing basis, Bundy would have Cooper of the National Security Council staff compile weekly lists of outrages by the Viet Cong and North Vietnam to justify the continuing airstrikes on the North. Over time, as the American public became accustomed to the bombing of North Vietnam, airstrikes could become less associated with specific Viet Cong actions. To preserve consensus and prevent a divisive debate over Vietnam, Johnson kept his policy deliberately ambiguous. The morning after the Ply Khu reprisal strikes, he invited key senators and congressmen to an NSC meeting. McNamara and Wheeler helped Johnson maintain a facade of consultation with Congress, even as the president obscured the changing role of the United States in the war. To appease both Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, a Democrat, who favored a negotiated settlement, and Republican Representative Gerald Ford, the House Minority Leader, who advocated additional airstrikes against the three targets that had been weathered in the day before, the president's advisors described the airstrikes against North Vietnam as mere reprisals. McNamara explained that he did not want the communists to get the wrong signal and think we are launching an offensive. Wheeler supported McNamara's distortion, as he had done during the Gulf of Tonkin affair, although he personally favored another reprisal strike and had just been ordered to develop plans for an 8-week air campaign against North Vietnam. Wheeler told the legislators that, because the bombing was merely a reprisal, subsequent airstrikes on three targets are not necessary from a military point of view, even though he was planning an extended campaign. After hearing the arguments for and against additional strikes on North Vietnam, the president approved a South Vietnamese attack against one target, but denied permission for additional strikes by American aircraft. 3 days later, another Viet Cong attack permitted Johnson to maintain the facade of reprisal bombing while embarking on the long-anticipated program of graduated pressure against North Vietnam. On February 10th, Viet Cong terrorists bombed an American enlisted soldier's barracks in the coastal city of Quy Nhon. The blast left 23 dead and 22 others wounded. In a National Security Council meeting on the same day, the president approved a reprisal strike on two military targets in the southern portion of North Vietnam. Johnson and his advisors agreed that they should not spell out in any detail what we had undertaken to do. The results of the strike after the Quy Nhon attack were as disappointing as those of the attack after Pleiku. The Joint Chiefs had proposed a massive raid against seven targets. McNamara recommended only three, and Ball urged the president to limit the strikes further to the two southernmost targets. Johnson accepted Ball's position. American naval aircraft were to strike Chan Hoa barracks, while South Vietnamese Air Force and Farmgate aircraft hit Vu Con barracks. Cloud cover once again forced naval aircraft to fly below optimal altitude, and North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gunners barraged them. 100 bomb and rocket-laden aircraft hit only 23 of the 76 buildings in the target areas, and three aircraft fell to enemy fire. On February 7th, 8th, and 11th, the United States had launched 267 aircraft sorties against 491 buildings and had destroyed only 47 of them. Operations at the North Vietnamese barracks continued unimpaired. McNamara, disappointed by the results, addressed a memo to Wheeler that reflected the general confusion surrounding the gradual application of force against North Vietnam. He was torn between his expectation that the raids would have inflicted greater damage and his belief that the objective of the airstrikes was communication. He told Wheeler, "Surely we cannot continue for months accomplishing no more with 267 sorties than we did with these missions." Simultaneously, however, the Secretary of Defense seemed to reassure himself with the observation that "our primary objective, of course, was to communicate our political resolve. This, I believe, we did." Still, he urged Wheeler to take corrective measures. He told the chairman that future communications of resolve would carry a hollow ring unless American aircraft could inflict more damage. The former Air Force statistician suggested that Wheeler and the Joint Chiefs choose different targets, change the weights of effort against them, or change the composition of the attacking force. Limitations on the use of force and the centralization of decision-making in the White House compounded the difficulties of bad weather, enemy air defenses, and general imprecision of bombing. Prior to the Quy Nhon strikes, separate proposals for reprisal targets came from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, McNamara, and Taylor. The Joint Chiefs sent General Westmoreland and Admiral Sharp a series of orders and counterorders that confused the planning process. Air crews could not make final preparations until the president decided to strike yet another combination of targets. Westmoreland reported that conflicting orders had exhausted and confused his staff and whiplashed the South Vietnamese Air Force. Despite the poor results of the initial airstrikes, McNamara's guidance to the chiefs sharply limited the scope and intensity of the bombing. On February 8th, when the defense secretary asked Wheeler to develop an 8-week program of pre-planned airstrikes against North Vietnam that would appear as reprisals for North Vietnamese and Viet Cong provocations, he told the chiefs to plan for no more than 2 to 3 attacks per week. All targets were to be south of the 19th parallel, and the MiG fighter base at Phuc Yen Airfield remained off limits. McNamara had once again structured his request to constrain the chiefs from providing broad-based advice. One might have expected General LeMay to contest McNamara's limitations and controls over the air campaign. 1 week prior to McNamara's request, however, LeMay had brought to a close his 34-year career as a military officer. His replacement was General John P. McConnell. The president and his top advisors long anticipating LeMay's retirement, had selected McConnell 10 months earlier and installed him, meanwhile, as Air Force Vice Chief of Staff. The contrast between McConnell and LeMay seems stark. Newsweek ran side-by-side photos of the two officers and opined that McConnell's brains and thrust had replaced LeMay's dedication and crust. Unlike LeMay's gruff manner and appearance, McConnell's countenance was kind and thoughtful. Time announced that McConnell's appointment marked an end of an era in military leadership. Pentagon analysts predicted that, under the management of this new breed of officer, inter-service rivalry would diminish and relations between civilian and military officials would flourish. Indeed, McConnell had a friendlier relationship with McNamara and other civilian officials in the Pentagon than did LeMay. As deputy NATO commander in Europe, he had impressed the Secretary of Defense with incisive, well-organized briefings. By appointing McConnell, Johnson appeared to have completed the shift of the JCS away from heroes to military men who were McNamara-style planners and thinkers. Taylor had recommended McConnell as LeMay's successor as early as January 1964. In addition to his reputation as a McNamara man who supported the defense secretary's Pentagon reforms, the general had established a close personal rapport with the president, becoming acquainted with Johnson in 1957 when he traveled to his Texas ranch to brief him on issues concerning the Strategic Air Command. McConnell recalled that Johnson was a great host and very keen. The Air Force officers shared a very enjoyable association with Johnson as they rode all over the ranch, swam in the pool, shot pistols, and visited neighbors. The future president had even personally served McConnell breakfast in bed. LBJ again wanted to appoint a chief on whose support he could count, because he continued to fear resistance to his Vietnam policy from the military. McConnell was a wise choice. Despite their previous association, the president wanted to confirm McConnell's dependability. In early 1964, when he was considering McConnell for the chief of staff position, Johnson arranged for the general to return from Europe for an interview in the White House. Getting right to the point, Johnson asked if McConnell would support policies inconsistent with his professional military opinion. The general assured the president that even if he did not have faith in the administration's policies, he would still go ahead and carry out his decisions to the best of my ability, and I would see also to it that the entire Air Force did the same. The new Air Force Chief of Staff saw his role as providing McNamara and Johnson suitable alternatives for the application of military power so they might choose the one which best solved the problem as they saw it. McConnell had given Johnson the right answer. McConnell's can-do attitude and personal loyalty predisposed him to serve more as a technician than as an advisor. He would support the strategy of the president and the Secretary of Defense with as many or as few bombing runs on North Vietnam as the civilian leaders required. McConnell later recalled that he, like Wheeler, went on to develop a close personal friendship with the president. McConnell's relationship with Army Chief of Staff Johnson, however, was less than tranquil. Not only did the two men differ in their institutional perspectives concerning the use of military force, but the two future heads of their respective services had experienced a difficult relationship as cadets at West Point. McConnell, an Arkansan, arrived at West Point with Earl Wheeler in 1929 after graduating magna cum laude from his home state's Henderson Brown College. In contrast to Harold Johnson's mediocre record as a cadet, McConnell rose to the highest cadet rank of first captain. During his last year at West Point, McConnell was manager of the football team, and Johnson, a year behind McConnell, was assistant manager. Johnson remembered that McConnell had delegated the hard work to Johnson, but kept all the credit for himself. Johnson may also have been uncomfortable with McConnell's heavy drinking, which, as the Vietnam War escalated, developed into alcoholism. It would be up to Earl Wheeler, a West Point classmate of McConnell's, to mediate between the two. Johnson's and McConnell's institutional perspectives, however, were irreconcilable. Like LeMay, McConnell advocated a massive air campaign that would bring North Vietnam to its knees and obviate the use of American ground forces. To prepare for the campaign, he proposed deploying 15 additional squadrons of aircraft to the Pacific. Harold Johnson, who recalled the bitter experience of land warfare in Korea and believed that bombing North Vietnam would actually cause the deployment of U.S. ground combat troops to Southeast Asia, remained more concerned than his colleagues about the possibility of Chinese intervention in Vietnam. Worried that the war might escalate, Johnson favored sharp limitations on the air campaign. He argued that the deployment of 15 squadrons was overkill, and noting that there were already 865 U.S. aircraft in the Pacific, suggested that the Air Force defer deploying additional aircraft until there was a demonstrable need for them. He recommended that to deter a communist ground offensive, two army divisions deploy to Thailand before airstrikes against the North began. Rather than express their differences of opinion to the Secretary of Defense and the President, General Wheeler talked Johnson and the other chiefs into submitting a consensus position. Wheeler's motivation was practical, consistent with his desire to create a compromise and avoid confrontation. He sought to protect the limited influence of the Joint Chiefs, and he believed that McNamara and the President would use the chiefs' differences to weaken JCS influence over Vietnam policy decisions. McNamara, who believed that one raid each week would make the air campaign sufficiently intense, further encouraged Wheeler to broker a compromise between his colleagues on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He suggested to the general that the JCS go along with the limitations on the use of force in the near term, and promised that if the early actions failed, the president would increase the military effort against North Vietnam. What was needed immediately, McNamara argued, was a bombing campaign that could gain LBJ's approval. Besides, McNamara observed, the chiefs could not prove that the sharply limited actions against North Vietnam would not work. To form a consensus, Wheeler suppressed JCS misgivings about McNamara's strategy for deepening American involvement in the war, and advocated force deployments that he knew would prove inadequate in the long term. Despite the Army staff's assessment that airstrikes would be ineffective and instigate the deployment of U.S. ground combat units to Southeast Asia, the Army Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans and Operations, Lieutenant General Bruce Palmer, recalled that he and General Johnson were persuaded to pursue the air war solution on the grounds that all could agree at least that it was worth the effort and there was no harm in trying it. Wheeler suggested that the chiefs focus first on gaining approval for the deployment of smaller numbers of aircraft and ground troops. Once those forces had been approved and reached their stations, the JCS would study further deployments as a matter of priority. In retrospect, Palmer concluded that concealing the chief's reservations about the incremental escalation of the war was a disservice. Wheeler appealed to the chief's common belief that communism had to be stopped in Vietnam, and he structured his compromise to appeal to each of the services. For the Army, Wheeler reduced the number of air squadrons from 15 to 9, writing that airstrikes almost certainly would not lead Hanoi to restrain the Viet Cong. In further deference to Harold Johnson's view that the war would be won or lost on the ground, the chiefs pressed for invasions into Laos by South Vietnamese forces. Under Wheeler's proposal, the Army would send a brigade, one-third of a division, to Thailand, and the Marine Corps would deploy a brigade to the South Vietnamese port city of Da Nang. The Air Force would have to settle for six fewer squadrons of aircraft and a limited air campaign in the short term, but it could look forward to larger deployments and less constrained action in the future. The Navy would participate in the airstrikes and augment bombing with naval bombardment. On February 11th, the JCS gave McNamara its plan for an 8-week program for the air campaign, consistent with the restrictions he had imposed. The plan called for U.S. and South Vietnamese aircraft attacks on four fixed targets and air interdiction missions over two road segments per week. If the insurgency continues with North Vietnamese support, strikes against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam will be extended with intensified efforts against targets north of the 19th parallel, the plan continued. In case the president was willing to approve more intensive airstrikes immediately, the chiefs presented options to strike either 7 or 10 targets per week. All targets were military, barracks, storage depots, and bridges. The JCS estimated for each option the number of sorties per target and the type of aircraft that should conduct each mission. The code name for the air campaign was Rolling Thunder. The president approved continuing airstrikes against North Vietnam without considering the possibility that his decision might accelerate the deployment of U.S. ground combat units to South Vietnam. Years afterward, McNamara claimed that the beginning of the air war unexpectedly triggered the introduction of U.S. troops into ground combat. Harold Johnson, however, had warned that this might happen, but McNamara, along with Taylor, had suppressed any discussion of the use of ground forces during the policy deliberations in November and December 1964. In February 1965, the Secretary of Defense, while pursuing relentlessly the implementation of graduated pressure on North Vietnam, continued to ignore JCS recommendations that U.S. Marines and Army troops deployed to Southeast Asia concurrent with the initiation of Rolling Thunder. Wheeler's compromise clouded the recommendation for ground troops, and McNamara's control over and selective use of the advice he received overshadowed the issue completely. After gaining presidential approval for continuing action against North Vietnam, it proved difficult to get Rolling Thunder underway. On February 18th, 1 week after they submitted their compromise memo to McNamara, the JCS issued the execute order for Rolling Thunder 1. United States and South Vietnamese aircraft were to strike a North Vietnamese naval base on February 20th. The first six attempts to begin the bombing, however, failed due to an attempted coup in Saigon, poor weather, and concern over initiating the airstrikes concurrent with a communist conclave in Moscow. The first Rolling Thunder mission was not conducted until March 2nd. Although bolstering the morale of the South Vietnamese people and enhancing the stability of the Saigon government had become one of the objectives of the air campaign, the chronic political turbulence in the South remained the principal obstacle to extending the war to the North. In mid-February 1965, even though there was virtually no government in Saigon, Taylor remained sanguine about Rolling Thunder's prospects. Although President Johnson had concluded that General Khan was the de facto leader in South Vietnam, Taylor, like Lodge before him, had decided to take an active role in forcing a change in the political power structure. On January 26th, General Khan had installed Nguyen Xuan Oanh as premier. Oanh, a Harvard-trained economist who had worked for the United States government and was considered very pro-American, came to power in the midst of newly intensified Buddhist protests and riots. students burned the United States Information Service Center in Hue and sacked the center in Saigon as well. A CIA report attributed the unrest to a nationalistic, social, and political revolution. Taylor, however, blamed General Khan for the latest outburst of anti-Americanism, labeling him a communist sympathizer and hoping thereby to undermine his credibility with the South Vietnamese military. The weakening of Khan's authority, without an heir apparent to the leadership of the military, threw Saigon into another round of turmoil as senior South Vietnamese military officers scrambled to fill the power vacuum. Between February 19th and 27th, U. Alexis Johnson felt as if he were living through a movie shown several times normal speed. I had to strain just to follow what the actors were saying and doing, let alone make sense of it all. General Phat and Colonel Pham Ngoc Thao, a secret agent of Hanoi, attempted to kidnap Khan and wrest power from the Armed Forces Council. Khan and Air Vice Marshal Ki narrowly escaped capture. Ki found sanctuary at the Benoit Air Base, from which he issued orders to bomb the coup headquarters in Saigon. Johnson, Taylor, and the embassy staff worked around the clock to prevent chaos. While bombers flew low over the embassy, General Westmoreland frantically attempted to dissuade Ki from attacking units of his own armed forces. At the last moment, Westmoreland and U. Alexis Johnson arranged a temporary ceasefire. As tensions eased, General Khan and the officers of the Armed Forces Council used the respite to gather troops loyal to their cause. The strain of the coup attempt and Taylor's effort to undermine Khan widened the rift between Khan and the Armed Forces Council. The council resented Khan's attempts to bypass them to solicit support from lower-ranking officers. The generals demanded Khan's resignation, recognizing that he had lost his base of support. Khan reluctantly acquiesced. On February 25th, after receiving full military honors, Khan and his family boarded a Paris-bound Pan Am Clipper. It seemed a victory for Taylor. Alexis Johnson recalled that there was not a wet eye in the crowd. Taylor regarded Khan's departure as a personal triumph and urged the bombing of North Vietnam with renewed enthusiasm. After Khan's plane lifted off, Taylor sent a terse cable to Washington. Khan airborne. Khat has given political clearances for February 26 strike. The day after Khan's departure, Taylor told Premier Phan Hoi Quat and other top officials of the South Vietnamese government that direct American action against North Vietnam may be the turning point that could reverse the trend of the war. He informed the South Vietnamese generals and reported separately to Washington that the initial bombing of the North had resulted in an upsurge of hope among the people of South Vietnam. Taylor urged the South Vietnamese generals to unite, set their sights on victory, and vigorously pursue it. He told them that they could make theirs the victory government. Taylor's victory over Khan proved ephemeral, for the military situation in South Vietnam had become desperate. The Viet Cong controlled over half of the country, and the fighting reached a new level of intensity. In January, Hanoi's leaders had decided to risk an attempt to destroy the South Vietnamese army before the United States could intervene directly in the war. The Viet Cong launched concentrated attacks on isolated South Vietnamese army outposts and lines of communication. American and South Vietnamese casualties rose sharply. In the week prior to Khan's departure, 36 Americans were killed in action, 196 wounded, and one was missing. Even more ominous, South Vietnamese army forces lost 1,555 men during the same period. Due to battle losses and inattention of commanders preoccupied with political intrigue in Saigon, morale in the South Vietnamese armed forces fell dramatically. As Taylor sent his message of hope for what bombing North Vietnam might accomplish, South Vietnamese Armed Forces soldiers were deserting at a rate exceeding 350 per day. In contrast to Taylor's belief that the airstrikes against the North could reverse the deteriorating situation, the U.S. Intelligence Board concluded that bombing North Vietnam would probably not cause the Hanoi government to cease supporting the insurgency in the South and might even result in an intensification of Viet Cong efforts in the expectation of early victory. Despite the ambassador's hopes that bombing would enhance governmental stability in the South, the CIA predicted further power struggles within the South Vietnamese government and noted that Khan's departure, with no specific heir to the leadership of the military, merely opens up new opportunities for numerous aspirants to the role of military strongman. In short, the prospects for achieving a stable and effective government in the near future remained exceedingly slim. Taylor, however, staunchly advocated rolling thunder. Westmoreland recalled that Taylor was really convinced the graduated response was going to work and continued to believe that Hanoi would collaborate in obtaining cessation of the insurgency, not just stop its support. The ambassador predicted that bombing North Vietnam would affect the minds of the Hanoi leadership to convince them that they must stop their aggression and dissuade the Viet Cong from continuing their sabotage or else pay a prohibitively high price. According to Taylor, the bombing would raise government of Vietnam morale and depress that of the Viet Cong, who would see they no longer had a safe haven. Although he did not agree with what he regarded as Taylor's pie-in-the-sky hopes for rolling thunder, Westmoreland saw no harm coming from it. He was skeptical, but like the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he concluded that the limited strikes against North Vietnam were worth trying. If the bombing failed, the United States would simply expand its effort to save South Vietnam. It might seem inconsistent that Taylor, once an avowed critic of air power, would have become such an energetic advocate for bombing North Vietnam. Although Taylor had recommended introducing ground troops into South Vietnam as early as November 1961, he thought that U.S. combat units should join the fight against the Viet Cong only as a last resort. To Taylor, Vietnam was an experiment in stopping communist insurgencies. Since the end of 1961, Taylor had tried to ensure that the experiment succeeded. The large-scale deployment of American ground combat units, however, eventually revealed that it had failed. Hugh Alexis Johnson recalled that Taylor's persistent advocacy of bombing the North was based in part in the ambassador's desire to quiet the growing push for commitment of American ground forces. Bombing North Vietnam seemed to be the only remaining option for a man whose personal reputation and legacy had become inextricably linked to the counterinsurgency effort in Vietnam. Westmoreland recalled that Taylor considered rolling thunder a cheap way of casting our lot towards some course of action that might have some prospect of success. So desperately did Taylor want the experiment in counterinsurgency to succeed that he deleted paragraphs of CIA reports that expressed doubts about the air campaign before forwarding them to keep the president from losing faith in the bombing. General Westmoreland did not share Taylor's reluctance to introduce American ground combat units. Like Harold Johnson, Westmoreland believed that ground forces should deploy to South Vietnam before the initiation of Rolling Thunder. On February 9th, in the wake of the Ply Khu attack, Westmoreland sent a cable to Wheeler, alerting the chairman that the situation in South Vietnam might require U.S. combat forces in division strength to protect U.S. personnel and installations. In reply, Wheeler asked him for the numbers and types of units he needed. On February 17th, Westmoreland prioritized three places that required Americans for security. Da Nang, the Greater Saigon Area, and Nha Trang. Admiral Sharp agreed with Westmoreland's assessment and recommended the deployment of a Marine Expeditionary Brigade, or MEB, to Da Nang. The chiefs had recommended deploying an MEB in their compromise memorandum of February 11th, and on February 18th, the JCS once again forwarded the recommendation to McNamara. It would be up to Westmoreland to persuade Taylor to go along with the deployment. Taylor resisted. On February 22nd, the ambassador objected strenuously to any deployment of American combat troops to South Vietnam. Taylor argued that white-faced American soldiers were not suitable guerrilla fighters for Asian forests and jungles, and warned that U.S. troops would do no better than had the French 10 years earlier. He predicted that the introduction of U.S. ground combat forces would sap the Army of the Republic of Vietnam's determination to fight and lead to tensions between American soldiers and Vietnamese civilians. Taylor considered the JCS plan to introduce an entire MEB a grandiose scheme that far exceeded any military requirement for security. Despite these objections, Westmoreland got Taylor to compromise. Taylor hoped that the deployment of a small force would quell calls for the Marine Brigade and other units. Instead of an entire brigade, Westmoreland and Taylor asked for one-third of that force, a Marine Battalion Landing Team, or BLT, of 1,200 men, to deploy to Da Nang. Taylor suggested that a small force would be more manageable from the point of view of accommodating it on base and absorbing it into the Da Nang community. He recognized, however, that once American ground forces arrived in any number, it will be very difficult to hold the line on further deployments. He conceded the need for one battalion, but urged that the United States adhere to our past policy of keeping our ground forces out of a direct counterinsurgency role. On February 26th, during a meeting with Rusk, McNamara, Ball, and McGeorge Bundy, LBJ approved deploying a helicopter squadron and two Marine battalions to Da Nang, a force more than twice as large as Taylor thought necessary. The decision was casual and made without consideration of the radically changed nature of the American commitment once U.S. ground combat units entered South Vietnam. It seemed an easy decision to the president because it represented a consensus among his civilian advisors, and the action could be justified under the compelling argument that U.S. installations and people had to be protected. His civilian advisors viewed the deployments as a reversible show of force or a benign defensive action. His military advisors, anxious to gain approval for further deployments, viewed the initial Marine deployments as the first step in transforming the war in the South to an American war. As Taylor had feared, his compromise on the principle of troop deployments opened the door for much larger deployments and moved America one step closer to direct intervention on the ground in South Vietnam. Westmoreland had agreed to a small force, but resolved to keep his options open for reinforcement, although his compromise with Taylor forced him to request only one Marine battalion initially. Westmoreland urged that the entire brigade deploy on a phased basis. Westmoreland must have been encouraged by the president's approval of two battalions and a squadron of helicopters. Like Westmoreland, Earl Wheeler considered the introduction of the ground troops as the first installment on a much larger deployment. It meant an Americanization of the war. Although the JCS memorandum to McNamara of February 11th recommended deploying only one Army brigade to Thailand and additional aircraft to the Western Pacific region, Wheeler had begun planning for the deployment of two Army divisions and six additional air squadrons to Southeast Asia. He had also begun to consider moving a third U.S. division into a position along the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. The first deployments would provide security for U.S. bases and personnel, and the third would act in